for the last 30 years, I have left a double life. During the week, I have been a very pious Muslim, following rituals. During my youth, joining various Muslim organizations, including the evangelicals, the political organizations like Jamaat-e-Islami, supporting the Iranian revolution, and so on and so forth. But that was only on Monday and Friday. On Saturday and Sunday, that weekend, I became a very modern person. So in the 60s, I was a flower child. In the 70s, I was a teddy boy. In the 80s, I developed some sense and discovered that, in fact, the kind of modernity I was seeking at the weekend was actually undermining my identity and status, which I try to seek and practice during the week. Now, this is a true story. I did live a double life. To some extent, I still do. And it is also true to say that during my youth, right from early teenage times, I have tried to discover different varieties of Islam and have consciously sought to join various movements. I mean, I became a Sufi for a short period, you know, I became a revolutionary, I became a postmodern Muslim, and so on and so forth. And this led to various adventures, some hair-raising, some not very hair-raising, some humorous, but I would like to say absolutely nothing about them for a simple reason that they are all described in this book, which I'm sure you all want to buy, so I don't want to ruin your pleasure by telling you what the book contains. What I would say is that all my Islamic quests eventually led me to what I would call three realizations. And these realizations are essentially, I see them as metaphysical catastrophes. That there is something happened within the history of Islam, in the early history of Islam, and something happened in the contemporary history of Islam, which combined together, in my mind at least, have generated what I call the three metaphysical catastrophes. And it is these catastrophes that, in fact, have become quite problematic, not just with the notion, not just with Islamic identity itself, but with the very notion of Islam itself. And they're very problematic for me as a believing Muslim, skeptical though I am, questioning though I am, but at the end of the day, I am a very much a believing Muslim. Now, the first metaphysical catastrophe, I think, is the idea that the Sharia, that Islamic law, is divine. Most Muslims take that for granted. In fact, in the 70s and the 80s, when I was a Muslim journalist, working for mainstream newspapers as well as for Muslim papers covering the Muslim world on issues of science, politics, and so on and so forth, Muslims everywhere demanded the Sharia, and to some extent today too, Muslims are everywhere are demanding the Sharia. And Sharia is seen as a priori given, as divine, as something that cannot be changed. And in fact, my own journey for the last 30 years has been, if you like, a quest to realize the paradise that the Sharia promises, the utopia that Sharia is supposed to deliver at the end of the day, because it is very much a divine institution. But my own contention is that Sharia is a socially constructed institution in history. It was first developed during the Abbasid period. It was formulated by people who were trying to solve the problems of their own time. And over the years, this particular institution has been, if you like, instrumentalized, institutionalized, cast in stone, frozen in history, made divine and unchanging. Now, that has a very interesting consequence for me as a believer. Because as a believer, if everything is a priori given, then what do? I have absolute no agency whatsoever. And I think that is the second metaphysical catastrophe. That in fact, the way we perceive the Sharia, it leaves the human out of the equation and makes the believers redundant. Believers are then simply empty vessels into which you pour this vast body of knowledge, Sharia, jurisprudence, all the historical baggage, and it's almost like a mechanical system. You turn the handle and some sort of answers come out at the end. And the believer itself does not engage with either with the sacred texts of Islam or uses his or her own mind to understand, to struggle. Indeed, my own particular quest has been to try and struggle with the sacred text, to try and find new meaning within this Islam Muslim sacred text, meaning the Quran and indeed the life of the Prophet. However, the way the Muslims as a whole perceive the Sharia, it deprives the average believing Muslim of agency. And I think that has become quite a serious problem within contemporary Islam. The last of the metaphysical catastrophe is more recent nature. Here, Islam is equated with the nation state. Essentially, if you believe that Sharia is going to deliver some sort of paradise, some sort of utopia, it's divine, it's unchanging, and you impose that on a nation state, then of course you have created a paradise. Essentially, this equation that Islam equals a state is a post-1950s equation. It's the equation that emerged mainly after Muslim countries gained their independence during the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I have lived in such paradises. I have lived in Saudi Arabia from 1974 to 79 as a young man, thinking that that is the ideal place to be. You know, here you have a state that practices Sharia law, you know, that is run on Islamic principle. It is, you know, probably the best thing that a young person, I have not always been as old as I look. In those days I was somewhat younger and more idealistic, and I actually thought that for a young Muslim there could be nothing better than living in Mecca, living in Saudi Arabia, living in an Islamic state. And that was a very rude awakening. I discovered it was a very nasty state. I discovered it was a semi-fascist state. I discovered it was a brutal state. I discovered it was a very anti-human state. I discovered that was a state that more or less marginalized, demonized, and isolated half of the society, namely the women. I discovered that some of its laws were so inhuman that I could not remotely recognize them or associate them with my own humanity. For a simple thing, everybody in Saudi Arabia wears white. Well, it stands to reason. They wear the thobe, which is very loose. You know, you're wondering about, the air is circulating, it's white, the sun is shining, the temperature is 110 degrees. You know, it's about the coolest thing you can wear. But women have to wear black by law. In other words, all the paraphernalia they use to cover themselves from top to bottom has to be black by law. They cannot wear a white jilbab or a white parda or a white anything. It has to be black by law. Now that is about the most anti-human law I think you can imagine. And of course this law is justified in Islamic terms, chapter and verse and so on and so forth. Later on, of course, as I said, I became a revolutionary and actually saw another Islamic state being created, and that was Iran. If you read, one of the good things is that I don't teach and I don't have many students, because the students tend to have a habit of digging up your old articles and quoting them. The very reader that was mentioned, Islam Postmodernism and Other Futures, Ziauddin Sardar reader, was done by one of my ex-students and a colleague. And it was a battle because it's less than half the size it originally was. And the remaining half was so embarrassing that I had to plead with them because they dug up my articles which I wrote during the Iranian Revolution saying, you know, here we have another utopia and it's going to save us all. Very embarrassing indeed. But fortunately, I persuaded them not to include it in that book. So here we had a state where Islam and state were one thing, where Sharia was the law of the state. And what we actually saw was a very nasty, authoritarian state, which was basically devouring its own children. It was devouring its own citizens. So the equation Islam equals state is is, as far as my own experience is concerned, and as far as I believe, is an equation of authoritarianism. The moment you equate Islam with state, you end up with a particular type of state which resembles either Saudi Arabia or Iran, parts of Pakistan, somewhat a bit like Sudan, and so on and so forth. And largely this is because the Sharia that is perceived and imposed on this Islamic state is essentially a product of 8th and 9th century. And therefore it reproduces the conditions of 8th and 9th century. And this is not surprising that the kind of states you then produce actually resembles the medieval states that existed in the 8th and 9th century. So these are the three kind of metaphysical catastrophes that I think Muslims have committed on themselves, and it is something that we need to rescue ourselves with. That's so much for the week, but what about the weekend? Of course, as I said, at the weekend, I was very modern. Indeed, I even changed my clothes, wore the latest fashion I could get. And I was also a secret socialist, I also should point out, which was very dangerous because some of my colleagues had declared that socialism is kufr. That means it's unbelief. So for me to be a secret socialist during the height of the period that I was also supporting Iranian Revolution and living in Saudi Arabia was not a very healthy thing to do. But somehow I survived. But I discovered that I have some serious problems with modernity too. Weekend brings its own problems. And one of my main problems with modernity is that it doesn't recognize my existence. Actually, it has defined me out of existence. So while I may have a very troubled week, at the weekend when I am very modern, I do not actually exist. Take my history, take the history of Islam. The history of Islam is not really part of the modern history. Modernity defines Western history as universal history, in which the histories of other societies, cultures, civilizations like Islam, China, Japan, are mere small tributaries. In some cases, of course, even the existence of these tributaries is not recognized. If you look at the history of art, what you learn in history of art is essentially history of Western art. There is no such thing as history of Chinese art, history of Japanese art. Indeed, some would argue that there is no such thing as Islamic art, as certain people at Harvard have argued. So I had a very specific problem with modernity and how modernity looks at history and how also modernity looks at tradition. As a Muslim, I am deeply embedded in history and tradition. And these two things have a great value for me. And I specifically want my history to be a living history. Of course, modernity defines me as a traditional person. By definition, I'm inferior. If you remember the classic studies of 50s and 60s, in fact, when I was a student myself, we studied, Daniel Lerner's passing of the traditional society. It was automatically assumed the traditional society has no future, that it will be replaced by modern society. And all traditional people, by definition, are inferior people. Their histories are not really not really worth bothering about. So as someone trying to be modern, I found that quite problematic. This afternoon, I went to the Burke Museum, which is a very, very nice, small museum. As you walk up, you're in the usual dinosaurs and children laughing. But on the side is this very interesting thing. It's called Pacific Voices. You go down the steps, and there's a little exhibition. It's called Pacific Voices. And in Pacific Voices, you have one culture after another, and you have little placards, and it says, well, the language was destroyed, or people were destroyed, we were murdered and massacred, we were abused, and now we are trying to, you know, fight crawl ourselves back. And you go along, and you see these things. The fact is that as a Muslim, I feel that's what modernity is trying to do to me as well. Modernity has already done that to numerous cultures. And that's exactly what it's trying to do to me, that it wants to put my history and my tradition in a as an exhibit, but not as something that is living and dynamic that I feel, that I actually live with. In a sense, also, modernity does not tolerate difference. It kind of essentially writes the difference out of the, more or less out of the equation. And this is, you can see that in the kind of disciplines that exist in that we teach, which are a product of modernity. If you take a discipline like development studies by definition defines Europe as developed, or industrial societies are developed, and if everybody else is underdeveloped or developing and forever catching up, in a sense, then everybody else by definition is defined out. And is always inferior. As my friend Ashish Nandi would say, that in a sense, the non-West can at best hope to catch up with the present of the West. The West always has a future, while we do not. I would argue that in fact, modernity has colonized the future, in a sense that non-Western cultures do not have much of a future, almost as defined, as promoted as it exists. It actually projects a future that is its own future, and I do not belong in that future. And that, of course, is very, very, very problematic. Very problematic. Since there are lots and lots of anthropologists in this gathering, I would just like to say one or two things. I mean, anthropology is a great modern discipline, is it not? When the white man wanted to study his own society, he called the discipline sociology. And the function of the discipline was, of course, to maintain, control, and manage the working classes. When he wanted to, and now increasingly she, wants to study the non-Western societies, they called it anthropology. And the function of anthropology was, of course, to maintain, control, manage non-Western societies and deliver them to colonialism. So here you have a discipline that is deeply embedded in colonial history. You know, anthropology and empire went hand in hand. You know, you don't need me to tell you that. Very prominent anthropologists here who will tell you. And now suddenly, of course, anthropology is talking about difference. It is actually the very discipline that is trying to give voice to the voiceless others, and so on and so forth. So I find myself in a very paradoxical situation. You know, here you are, here I am. 50, 60 years ago, my ancestors were being anthropologized and written out, and now I'm being anthropologized and being brought in, you know, as a kind of outsider who should be within. So modernity does create these kind of paradoxes, and I think over discipline restructure, anthropology, development studies, many great deal of natural science and so on and so forth, are deeply embedded and complicit in the project of modernity, which is essentially to marginalize and write off non-Western cultures. So you can imagine that I was a very troubled person. I was not very happy during the weekend, and I certainly wasn't very happy during the week. In a sense, what is the? How does one try to square this this circle? How does one proceed? Well, I would argue that we need to rethink both. We need to rethink modernity and rethink Islam. In a sense, both are quests for paradise. And we need to bring the two kind of desperate halves, I see, of somewhat in a synthetic whole. Just to illustrate how other people also experience this, I went to Indonesia recently. I'm doing a film for the BBC. It's kind of a journey through five Muslim countries: Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, Turkey, and Morocco. So I went to Indonesia, and I was walking the street, and I came across a barber's shop, and the barber inside was a woman, and she invited me in, and she said, "Would you like a cream bath?" And I thought, "My God, that's my day, a cream bath. I would love to have a cream bath." Turned out to be a hair wash, and she put me there and gave me a little hair wash. And as she was talking, I came to the conclusion that this woman, who was very modern and very kind of, you know, wearing a kind of skirt and all that, would most people would not remotely see her as pious in inverted commas, is in fact a highly pious person. And it transpired when we went to her home, you know, that she was covered. She was very devoted mother, teaching her children to pray and so on and so forth. So in a sense, there's a split there. That she has a modern existence where she tries to leave her religion out, as it were, and then she goes back to a religious life. It's a very schizophrenic, split personality existence. In Malaysia, I met an actress, a former actress, called Noor Kamalasari, and during her formal existence, she was a model, an actress, a television performer, a singer, you know, who can. Had a very outrageous existence. And then she suddenly realized that, in fact, there was more to life. And then she became totally Muslim, covered. And so I interviewed her, and now she was totally denouncing her former existence. The only way she could reconcile it is to denounce her former modernity, if you like. So in a sense, it's not just my story. I think it's a universal story that Muslims either have a split personality, or when they change from one kind of system to another, they feel the necessity to denounce what they were before, whether they were pious Muslims before or a very modern. Either way, they end up denying it. So in a sense, I think we need to bring, as Muslims people, we need to bring the two sides of the equations together and produce something that is meaningful. I think that can only be done if we rethink both varieties of paradigms. Both varieties of paradises are essentially monolithic constructions. Islam, as we perceive it today, is a highly monolithic. Despite all the variety, the theoretical Islam, the Islam that exists in books and things, tends to be very monolithic. And I think it is time that we looked at Islam in a more pluralistic way. We realize that, in fact, every generation has to reconstruct its own Sharia. That, in fact, the only thing we as Muslims can do is to interpret our sacred text and to reinterpret it and to reinterpret it. Specifically, when we believe that sacred text is eternal, then the only thing we really have is interpretation and countless interpretation. In a very old book, I think, which was mentioned, called The Future of Muslim Civilization, I actually argued that Islam has to be reinterpreted from epoch to epoch, which is about three, which I define an epoch as three generations, meaning 60 years, which I now come to believe more and more, that in fact Islam needs to be reinterpreted and needs to be reinterpreted continuously. We need to continuously question our texts in light of what we see. Similarly, I think we need to continuously interrogate modernity and actually open it up and realize that modernity is not something that is defined by the West. That in fact, non-Western societies can define their own modernity. That Islam too can define its own modernity with its own categories, its own ideas, within its own resources. And any culture that in fact exists today, by the simple fact that it exists today, is modern and can actually define its own modernity in its own terms. To some extent, this is already happening. I don't want to end on a pessimistic note. To some extent, this is already happening. I think Islam is being redefined, if you like, in a modern way in many places. To go back to Indonesia, I think you there's somebody attending this conference from Indonesia called Yulil Abdullah from Liberal Islam Network, who will tell you more about it than I can. In a sense, the relationship between the state and Islam has been totally redefined in Indonesia over the last 10 years. The new intellectual, the new Islamic intellectualism, as it is called, has argued that it's not Islam that equals state, but it is the approach that Muslims take to constructing a civil society that is the element of if like power and morality that we bring to the state. So the emphasis is not that there should be a Sharia law and Indonesia should be an Islamic state, but the emphasis is that pious Muslims should be engaged in political process, fighting corruption and creating a civic society. And they're defining civic societies in their own terms, not as accepted in a Western terms. With, you know, they're defining that within their own Islamic terms. Similarly, in Morocco, we've seen a whole group of both Muslim feminists as well as traditional Muslim scholars coming together to argue not just that Sharia cannot be changed, but to argue that Sharia should be changed. Not just that it should be changed, but they have actually changed the Sharia totally. So in fact, they have total new Islamic personal law, which bears very little to what we will regard, what traditional Muslims have seen as a conventional Islamic law. It bears very little resemblance to, say, the Islamic law that exists in Saudi Arabia or in Iran. They've redefined it totally in a totally different way. So the idea that a Muslim man can divorce a Muslim woman simply by saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you three times, is out. The idea that, by definition, a man is the head of the household is out. They've redefined that, in fact. Muslim marriage is a partnership, is defined as partnership in Islamic law, and therefore household should also be run in partnership, and so on and so forth. It's a very radical law, and it exists on the internet, and I invite you to actually look at it to see how, in fact, Islam is being redefined, and a whole new notion of Islamic modernity, if you like, is being created. So at the end, what I'm actually arguing for is that both Islam and modernity have seen the future in a very specific way. They've seen the future as a kind of mighty river, and this river is kind of flowing in a given direction, and then you try to adjust to this river, and by, you know, negotiating the eddies and the bumps and the waterfalls, but at the end of the day, the future is defined by the banks of the river, and the direction is given, the direction that the river is flowing. I'm suggesting that both Islam and modernity should be seen as an ocean. And in an ocean, of course, you can travel in any direction you like. In an ocean, you can define your own direction. You can negotiate different passages. You can travel from one place to another place by different routes. And so on and so forth. But what the ocean actually needs is a vision. And I think that's what both Islam and modernity need. And the core of Islam and modernity, what we need is a pluralistic vision of what it means to be human. At the end of the day, for me, Islam means nothing if it undermines my humanity. And at the end of the day, I have no time for modernity if it undermines my humanity. In both cases, I think we need a new vision of how to be human. Thank you very much.